This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 160th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, just look at what we've got on the menu, ladies and gentlemen. This will speak to the editor of Art Review magazine, fresh from publishing their always argumentative Power 100 list.
What's increasingly happening is that the sort of local scenes are becoming more important within themselves, and very few people are now managing to be truly global players.
We'll speak to the former tabloid hack who ran away and joined the good guys by making a mad documentary raking the muck on the Red Tops.
If you try and knock on his door and ask him a couple of questions, he hires security to come and stop you. And I think that that says all you need to know about the hypocrisy that exists amongst these people who claim they believe in journalism, claim they believe in those values.
Plus, we'll go for a wander in the world's largest outdoor art gallery in Brazil, and we'll learn how to check our mates in a foreign language at the premier Armenian chess school, and we'll enjoy an absolutely beautiful live Midori House session from Asaf Avidan, one of the hottest new talents in the whole wide world. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First, it's time to hear from our live Midori House session, and this week I'm very happy to welcome Asaf Avidan, an Israeli musician whose quite unbelievable voice is a cracked and beautiful instrument that's beguiled listeners on tracks like One Day and the heart-stopping new school torch song Different Pulses. Asaf is back in Europe, here in London indeed, for a few stripped-back dates in Islington, and here he is first with Over My Head. That was Asaf Avidan performing his new single Over My Head, and more from him later on in the show. Well, it's that time of the year in the art world. After Freeze Week in London and before the market's glam slam final furlong at Art Basel Miami Beach, when Art Review, that august organ of art criticism and oodles of glossy ads for upcoming shows, publishes its list of the 100 most powerful people in the art world, and it doesn't hide its light under an obscurely named bushel either. It's called the Art Review Power 100, and its editor is Mark Rappolt, and he swung by to explain the movers and shakers on this most esoteric of pop charts.
Basically, the list has four key factors that work for it. One is actually having done something in the last 12 months, which means that at least it's dynamic. The second is that you have an international influence rather than a purely local one. The third one is that you kind of influence the type of art that's being produced today. And the fourth is that you influence the way that art is perceived by a general public.
It's something that comes around every year. We always look forward to it. I think it's in its 13th. It's like Doctor Who. It's gone into its 13th incarnation this time. And top of the list is Nick Sirota, the director of the Tate. What does this tell us? Does this tell us that we're all more about institutions than the market this year? What are the runes that we can read?
I think maybe that one of the consequences of saying we have a global art world, which has been around for a while, is that to be at the top of the list, you need actually to be global, which is very hard if you have, you know, galleries tend to be physical spaces in particular places. And I think maybe the Tate success has been expanding itself beyond just the bricks and mortar south of the river and has become something that has its fingers in lots of pies around the world, whether it's through large patron committees that fund it or advice it's giving to other museums in Asia and the Middle East and around the world, really, even on Australia.
So it's an interesting thing, this idea that one museum or one museum brand can consult with others. I mean, there's obviously lots of famous sort of, as you say, bricks and mortar projects popping up in the Middle East, in Asia, all over the place. So the Tate has got its fingers in these pies as a consultant as well.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of, maybe we could call it in honour of Marina Abramovich, who's also in the top 10, the Tate method. And, you know, I think it's this way of linking in patrons, artists. So traditionally a museum validates artists by giving them shows. That's a sort of status sign. But increasingly museums like the Tate also validate collectors and patrons by allowing them onto their committees. And so I think that's expanded the reach they've had. And also the sort of this way of, maybe it's been forced by particularly our current government of fusing public and private. So the sort of public side that sort of acts as a museum that accredits things and the private side that acts as a fundraising body coming together.
And so have the Tate, it seems like the Tate have been very good then at doing this, have been good at making money or at least bringing money into the institutions bear its name. That's obviously a very important part of Nick Sirota's job, is not just to be an arbiter and a tastemaker, but be an attractive place for donors to put their cash.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly true. But I think it also reflects into models that some of the commercial galleries, David Zwerner and Howes & Worth, who are at the top of the list, are exploring, where they're trying to appear more like a museum. So they're very good at selling things and generating income that way. But they also recognise, I think, that maintaining value is also about the sort of aesthetic and cultural value of the stuff they're selling. And so you have, you know, Howes & Worth in Somerset, which is sort of increasingly like a museum. Their plans for a new museum in LA are also increasingly like a public museum rather than a private gallery. So I think that sort of system is filtering out into the private sector as well.
And this is obviously at the very top in terms of the money, the top echelon of the private galleries as well, the commercial galleries, David Zwerner, Howes & Worth, doing these things that are kind of, yeah, I mean, there are private museums all over the world. This is maybe kind of like how the Chinese museums are springing up.
Yeah.
But these people, these top gallerists as well, in order, I guess, to accrue value for the artists that are on their roster, they want to place their works, the works of those artists, into institutions. So there's an interesting relationship between someone like David Zwerner and Nick Sirota, for example, as well, isn't there?
Yeah, of course. And I think in that sense, also someone who buys a lot of work by a certain artist wants to see that artist in museums and may be inclined to help a museum acquire that work. And that can often happen via a commercial gallery.
Now, last year, your number one was Sheikh Mayasa from Qatar, who obviously went on a big buying spree and commissioned these huge works by Damien Hirst, etc., and put on big shows there in her home country. She slipped down the list. Was that a sort of bit of a flash in the pan? Or do you see the Middle East's sort of art buying power as sort of coming back? Or do you think it's sort of had its zenith in a way?
I mean, I think it's still there and there's no reason it shouldn't still be there. But I think in terms of influence, if you're buying all this work but not that many people are seeing that work, your influence is kind of diminished. And I think that was the reason they moved down, partly because I think there is a sort of suspicion of who are all these museums in Qatar for? And a suspicion
not many people go to them.
No. And I think particularly not, you know, many local people either. So it's sort of, if those museums are not having a big influence, then the influence in general diminishes. Although, of course, in the market sense, it can still have a big impact.
And I've read a quote, you talking about the Power 100 before this particular list, the 13th list before, talking about how, like in every sort of cultural industry, power lies in the hands of the distributors rather than the producers. That's why there are more gallerists than artists on your list. I think this is roughly about right. And that's a sort of interesting thing. So people will read this list, and there are a few, there's as we said, there's Marina Abramovich, Jeff Koons, and various people, Wolfgang Tillmann's on the list, who people will recognise. But there are no longer any of those artists that bestrode the 1990s, at least in the UK, like colossi, like the Damien Hirst and Tracy Emmons of this world. Are they left out the list to cause a bit of an argument, or is that a genuine thing? Is that a genuine comment on their influence?
I think it's a genuine comment. I think they haven't been on for the last couple of... Damien Hirst was the last one who departed the list last year. And I think while I definitely wouldn't dispute that if I wanted someone to understand Britain in the 1990s, a giant ashtray would be the perfect kind of symbol for it. I think you don't really encounter many younger artists saying, I want to be like Damien Hirst, or wanting to emulate him as an artist. Maybe they want to emulate his success, but I think his work itself doesn't have as big an influence as some of the people who are on that list. And it's purely for that reason that they're not on it.
It seems that this list is, I guess it obviously always has that sense of it being about taste makers, and it has an idea, a sense of wanting to future-proof itself as well as a list to be taken seriously. But there is a lean towards maybe the institutional, towards the serious. I noticed Claire Su is also on the list, who did the Asian Art Archive, which is sort of something that I guess Asia was sort of crying out for, a way to list the works that people have that they don't have, what sort of is in that, in the possession of that part of the world. There is a more perhaps institutional tone to this list, a bit more seriousness perhaps, rather than some of the splashy artist names that have been in it in the past. Is that true to say?
I think, well, someone like Claire's been on the list for 4 or 5 years. It's definitely a swing towards institutions, but I think in a funny way that's because when the market starts to run wild, people start to become conscious that they don't want, you know, art to be the slave to the market, its value to be totally in the hands of collectors and traders, and start to look for other ways that art can have value. And I think institutions, almost like a sort of incredibly safe bank for that kind of value, that they protect a certain value for art and become more important for that reason. Whereas if you're relying purely on trading, it can go up and down like any other market.
I know that Art Review has an Asian edition as well. I know that you do a lot of work out there yourself, Mark. What does the Power 100 tell us in terms of the influence, the rising influence of Asia, whether it's the market or whether it's artists themselves?
I mean, I think in reality what it tells us is that lots of people are very important in very local regions. I mean, we have a committee that decides the power list, and frequently the people in China and India on that committee would be like David Zwerner, Ivan Wirth. They don't really mean anything to me here. So I think what's increasingly happening is that the sort of local scenes are becoming more important within themselves, and very few people are now managing to be truly global players.
That was Mark Rapolt, editor of Art Review, and that essential power obsessed issue is out now in your local newsagent. After the break, we'll meet the hack who looked back.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our 4 daily news programmes, or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Band, where now we'll hear a tale of tabloid skullduggery, an obsession with telling the truth in a sea of lies, and trying to be the good guy in a den of thieves. Rich Pepiat was a reporter for Britain's splashiest, silliest, and perhaps most damaging tabloid, The Daily Star, who says his job was to find the bad in the ordinary and the downright awful in the foreign, the misunderstood, and those, frankly, unable to protect themselves, while working for a proprietor who squeezed the pips out of his staff. Many Fleet Street ears will burn as they watch Rich Pepiat's very funny firebrand of a movie, One Rogue Reporter. And that One Rogue Reporter, Rich Pepiat himself, came in to spill the beans.
We don't have a free press. We have a press which is in the hands of a very small number of politically motivated people.
Publishing stories which are false or distorted.
Leering at anything that's remotely naughty, sexy, upskirt.
We don't care how you get the story, just don't tell us the gory details, even if they're illegal. Just keep it to yourself.
Absolutely inhuman behaviour.
The press needs to be made accountable.
I guess with the whole Leveson inquiry thing and being involved in that, and certainly the way I left the industry and my opinion on what's gone wrong with a lot of mainstream journalism, you know, I was very annoyed at some of the things that people at Leveson Inquiry editors were getting away with saying. And they saw an opportunity to sort of go, well, I have these sort of skills of, you know, going after people. And I thought it makes quite a good film narrative, I guess.
Yeah, it sure does.
And so I thought, well, yeah, let's start doing it. And so it really did just start off as me and a mate who had a camera, thought, let's go and sort of stunt.
Hound the Hounders.
Yeah, and then just, they had no other plan for it other than that. And then it went quite well. And we thought, we better try and actually do something
get
with this.
Up.
And so it became a stand-up comedy show, which I did at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2012, I think. Yeah. And then it toured sort of in 2013. And then we came to the end of that tour. And again, we were like, we've got all this great footage that was in the stand-up show. We better make a documentary. And so, yeah, we did.
So when I landed a job at the Daily Star, one of Britain's biggest selling newspapers, I imagined I'd soon be travelling the world, covering wars and disasters and history in the making. What I didn't imagine myself doing would be dressing up as Santa and getting drunk with strippers. Or dressing up as a transvestite stripper. I got a £500 bonus for that, which, in the cold light of day, does make the whole episode feel the extra bit grubby.
You're at the Daily Star, and you one of the reasons you resigned was you were forced into sort of specifically anti-Islamic sort of kind of news stories, running various things, kind of making sort of ring up hate preachers and getting them to sort of spill bile all over the pages of the paper. That was kind of one of the reasons you left. And then you made this. Mm. Then you kind of thought, why am I working in this industry? And that's was the sort of genesis of the film.
I don't like to say force. People say that, and I don't like to use that term because no one held a gun to my head.
Yeah.
And I. You know, I do feel that, you know, I did certain things of my own free volition.
You were working in the culture of the paper.
Yeah, I mean,
which
that was the kind of reason I was doing it, but I don't think that absolves me of responsibility for what I was doing. And certainly part of the film is looking at that. And there's certainly an element of the film that is this cathartic sort of, you know, trying to atone for one's sins by sort of, you know, turn the tables on these editors and going after them. And yeah, I don't think we don't sort of foreground it too much, but I certainly think that is an undercurrent that runs throughout.
And as you said, this then kind of blossomed during the sort of Leveson era, didn't it? I mean, that was one of the reasons it came about. And you've got a lot of sort of, I guess they're familiar names to people that followed the Leveson inquiry in the UK. Steve Coogan, the actor, Hugh Grant, the actor, these various different people. People like Max Mosey as well, who was sort of hounded by, was it the Mail on Sunday? I don't know.
No, the News of the World.
News of the World.
We had John Prescott in there, MP Chris Bryant, Kate Smirthwaite, who's a comedian, John Bishop, the comedian. Lots and lots of great people who sort of agreed to come on board. I think the great thing about it is that they're speaking very frankly. Part of that's because often I'm catching them at parties and things like that, where I've managed to drag them into a side room when they're half cut.
This is your tabloid training.
Quite. You know, make sure you know, get a room at the side of a party that's nice and quiet. Set it up, and then you can
funnel your drunk guests in.
Funnel the drunk guests in and get them being very, very frank on camera. And I think that, you know, people will be surprised at some of the things that people in respectable, so-called respectable positions in politics, etc., are prepared to say about some members of the press.
What Martin Clark doesn't realise is that we're currently sitting right down his street.
Have you got any gossip for us? Are you on a diet or anything? Are you detoxing?
Who the hell are you?
Who the hell am I?
Yeah.
I'm just doing my job, mate. Just taking a few pics. I saw a nipple slit with Kim Kardashian earlier.
Yeah,
brilliant. I'll send it in. I'll send it across.
Funny. Seriously, who are you?
Doing my job, mate. Just doing my job. You know, taking a few pics.
What you may have missed there is a real treat for those of us who like to leer at pictures of flabby, middle-aged newspaper executives. A belly button slip. Ooh, check out that linty goodness.
And these guys, Hugh Grant, Steve Coogan, these people, as I said, would be familiar to people that follow Leveson because they sort of had an axe to grind. And also, I think, you know, they probably acted in the interests of the press rather than just their own. I mean, you know, they stood up on their soapboxes. They're in the film. Interestingly, though, former tabloid editor, you know, you've kind of doorstepped Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail here in the UK, Kelvin McKenzie, a former Sun editor. These people sort of by hook and by crook end up in your film. Yeah. Talk us about, because I mean, that's the doorstepping of Paul Dacre is an amusing thing. He, Private Eye is to be believed, has a fairly colourful, four-letter palette, put it that way, to a lot of his editorial staff meetings, the language they're in.
Certainly. He was fun. He managed to resist swearing too much in my company, but he did have a very burly security guard who certainly enjoyed trying to rough me up a little bit, and we had quite a standoff for about 12 hours at his door.
It was quite a standoff.
That was
Butch Cassidy, at the time
we were sort of like, this isn't quite going as planned, and then when we actually looked at it, we were like, no, this is excellent, because this man who, you know, has set himself up as the bastion of the free press and is all about, you know, the right of journalists to knock on doors and ask questions of people, if you try and knock on his door and ask him a couple of questions, he hires security to come and stop you, who physically will stop you knocking on his door. And I think that says all you need to know about the hypocrisy that exists amongst these people who claim they believe in journalism, claim they believe in those values. They're just businessmen who are interested in trying to make as much money as possible, and one rule for them, one rule for everyone else.
Being a tabloid writer, especially on a national, going to lots of sort of parties and all the rest of it, it's kind of the fun side of it. And you kind of do feel like not necessarily you're making a difference. It's nice that moment when you first see your name in print and you feel like what all your mates are doing, this is something a bit head and shoulders above it. When did it start to lose its luster, Rich? That, you know, maybe the Daily Star years, for example.
Certainly. When I suppose I started quite young, I was probably 22 when I first started working. I worked at the Mail on Sunday for a bit, and that's very young to be working on a national paper, and I was well out of my depth, I must say. And yeah, certainly the going to lots of parties, being young in your 20s, lots of free champagne, you can get in all the best clubs, hang out with celebrities, that does have a certain appeal. And your mates certainly go like, wow, you know, you've got a cracking job. And I think that I convinced myself of that a long time and just sort of used my daily hangovers to block out the fact that the substance of the job was a completely banal. You know, it was, you're just writing sensationalist shite, really, yeah, about celebrities, which, you know, wasn't really what I could see myself wanting to do in the long term. But then even worse than that was the political stuff, in that someone like the Daily Star is a right-wing tabloid, and you are basically being asked to find the facts which fit a certain narrative, which is, you know, immigration is bad, Muslims are bad, unions are bad. You know, it's just left-wing bashing as much as possible, and screw the facts. And certainly you do convince yourself, well, if I don't do it, someone else will. And, you know, it's not my job as a reporter just to say what I want to say about things. I'm paid by someone to take on their perspective. That's how journalism works. But then I guess it came to a point where I realised that you have got personal responsibility and you can't just keep excusing yourself. And also, I was still young. I didn't have a family or a mortgage or anything like that. And looking around my newsroom, I thought, you know what? There's no one here who could make that leap of just going sod it and just, you know, going out in a blaze of glory. And I knew, well, actually, if I did, what's the worst that could happen? I'd live on beans for 6 months. I mean, I'll get over it. I can rebuild. I can do something else. And then after a lot of whiskey one night, I just decided to bloody do it.
There's nothing more gratifying than seeing a bully being bullied.
You being a married man, sending racy text actually would be hypocritical, wouldn't it?
Rich Pepperwood is a very naughty boy and he's going to be sent to his room.
You couldn't write it, could you?
That was Rich Pepiat, whose One Rogue Reporter film is out now. Google that name and see what all the fuss is about. It's very amusing stuff. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll wander around the biggest outdoor art gallery in the world in Brazil. We'll go to Armenia to learn chess from the real home of the Grand Masters. And we'll fall in love a little more with the great Midori House session from Asaf Avidan. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Israeli singer-songwriter Asaf Avidan is our guest in the Midori House studio today. He's embarking on a part of his international tour that he calls Back to Basics, and he's been darting about all over the globe to do it. We had a quick chat about the rigours of songwriting and of touring, but first, here he is with Left Behind.
The summer sun is setting and the grass is turning gold. Another season's changing and I'm just getting old. The autumn leaves are raining and it's a sparrow's time to fall. Another season's fading now, I'm getting old. If you ever found a way to run as fast as time, you will find a wind that's blowing. Well, you tell her I was left behind. The winter frost is biting, even trees outside of cold. Another season's changing now, I'm getting old. The seeds of spring are spreading with life no man can hold. And another season's ending. Here I am, just getting old. If you ever find a way to run as fast as time, you will find a wind that's blowing. You tell her I was left behind. 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 Please tell her I was left behind. Tell her I was left behind. You tell her I was left behind. Please tell her I was left behind.
Asaf, thank you so much for a quite incendiary Midori House session. I don't know.
Thank
I was
you for
standing
having
there. Well, it's our very great pleasure. I was standing on the other side of the glass. This is meant to be a dead space. Mm-hmm. You're in Studio 2 here in Midori House. It's meant to be a dead space. We've never had a singer with the lungs that you've had and that such a beautiful voice.
Well,
that
you
can almost hear
whiskey,
it on the other side of the glass.
So yeah. I cannot complain.
Talk us through the tricks of keeping the voice in running order and working order, because you do a lot of touring. You've got a glass of Coke and a glass of whiskey in front of you. What are the brands that you have to have in your rider?
That's basically it. Some good Scotch whiskey, Coke, and I have this honey that I eat, Manuka honey.
Oh,
did
Manuka
you hear
honey.
About it? Yeah.
Okay, is that so, the thick, dark stuff?
It's a special one from New Zealand, and it's like a special bee with a special flower. And somebody once told me, a tour manager in the past told me that that's what Madonna has, and I don't know, I tried it once, and it's miraculous.
Miraculous.
Yes.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll tell you what.
No, and I swear, I get nothing out of it. I've become like a missionary of Manuka honey.
It's just good for sticking the set list up on the wall of the dressing room, presumably. Exactly. That's the best use for it. Maybe we can talk about the current tour. And it seems like you've been on a perma tour. Where, I mean, I know where you've been, I know where you're going, but what are the
that's kind of creepy, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I know what you throw to the garbage.
We'll be playing I'll be watching you by the police underneath this interview. But what are the best places? Is it the places that you have to crack as a performer, or is it the places that sing your choruses back to you? Where do you kind of like to go?
I just like warm audiences. And I say that, it sounds kind of obvious, but there's just specific places, like every time I play in Paris, every time I play in Hamburg, every time I play in Rome. My point is that it just has to do with some kind of dialogue happening in the show. I hate monologues. I hate just coming and doing my show and just feeling like this sterile environment. Anywhere, it doesn't matter what the venue looks like or where it is, but just having some feedback and then I feedback, you know, it's this, there's some magic that happens. I know it's cliche, but when an audience, there's this Leonard Cohen concert that I once saw on video where he stops, it's the 70s, you could get away with that, but he stops the show in the middle and says, listen, it's not working, take your money back, and he just walks off the stage because he doesn't feel that.
Right.
So I'm not that extreme, but I do love when it does happen.
Well, it's one of those things, I guess the audience has a responsibility, like the performer, to, it is a bit of a dialogue, isn't it, to kind of, not behave themselves, but maybe almost the opposite, to really get into it, to not be too polite. Is that what you want?
It is my job to get them there, but this tour is a bit weird. It's called the Back to Basics Tour, and it's an acoustic tour, and it's me sitting down. Usually,
just doing a number of Irish ballads.
Exactly.
On a rocking chair.
Exactly. Okay. There's some. Oh, God. I can hear that in my head. It's a very intimate, very therapeutic little thing that I do, and it's all seated venues, usually opera houses or like kind of concert halls. So of course people are polite. It's not the, you know, people don't dance and people don't cheer so much, and so it's kind of a weird experience coming from a rock and roll background. So I'm getting used to that, but even so, there's some places where even that show just brings something that is bigger than just my music, and it's bigger than, you know, those people who paid a babysitter and parking and got in there, and just something together, everybody together happens, and it's beautiful.
You're going from Back to Basics, you're putting the acoustic on the shelf, and you're taking back the band, you're going back, is it with the Mojos?
It's not, the Mojos ended.
No, that's ended.
Yeah.
Who's the new outfit?
It's the same band that's been touring with me for Different Pulses, the first solo album that I did, and there's three girls and three guys. It's nicer to tour that way, I guess.
Surfing on a unisex vibe.
Exactly.
And that's quite a different thing. That's a muscular thing. We talked before we turned the mics on about having the loudest drummer in history, a sort of supernatural loudness to a former drummer of yours.
Yeah.
What about, is this, do you have to audition drummers now in a different way, or do you just give up and do sign language?
No, I think I was angrier, and we were all angrier at the time. We felt that banging harder on our instruments and me killing my vocal cords even more than I usually do would be more dramatic, would reach some, but it's not, I don't feel that way anymore. I've gotten older and more mature, and I think there's, the beauty is in the nuances. And so there is a place for that loud banging, but there is, I try to have a wide spectrum, a whole palette of colors inside each song and inside the whole show.
That was Asaf Avidan. Before that, you heard him singing Left Behind. Up next, a massive art gallery. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. We now take a trip down to Brazil to visit the world's largest open-air art gallery. About an hour outside of Belo Horizonte, in the landlocked state of Minas Gerais, you can find Instituto Inotim, a botanical garden, live music venue, and complex of art galleries all mashed into one. The idea to create it came about back in the mid-1980s by mining millionaire Bernardo do Melo Paz, who used to live on the property. Slowly, he started to turn it into a botanical garden with rare plants from all over the world. Eventually, contemporary open-air sculptures were added, and then art galleries that started to receive guests by appointment only. Since 2006, Inhotim is now open to the public 7 days a week, and Monocle correspondent Sheena Rossiter visits Inhotim and takes us through the new way of experiencing art within a natural setting.
The daily busload of visitors creeps to a halt on a Saturday morning in Inhotim. As this fashionable crowd files off the bus, the sight that's seen before them is one so beautiful, it looks like a landscape painting itself. Nestled among mining towns, Inorchim is truly a diamond in the rough, having been groomed and perfectly curated over the years. Even the name of this place has a story behind it, as Rodrigo Mora, director of arts and culture programs at Inorchim, explains.
Inorchim, it's the name of a village that used to exist in this area. So the name of this village was given by the fact that there was supposedly an English farmer by the name Timothy that would have land here. And Nho, it's an archaic or old way to say Senhor, which means Mister, and Tim is just a short for Timothy. So this contraction of these two particles created the name Inorchim. And when we moved here and when we started the project, we thought that very important way to pay an homage to the history of this land and of this region was to keep its original name.
Twists and turns around every corner in this peaceful garden give visitors the feeling like they've fallen down the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland, with surprise sculptures around every corner, like Elio Ochisika's Magic Square No. 5. Standing brightly and reflecting off the plankton-infused green lake, it makes the body of water seem as if it was a piece of art in and of itself. And there's no shortage of galleries to explore either, with a total of 22 being dotted around the 110-hectare property. Here at the Galpon, Cardiff and Miller Gallery, visitors can hear Canadian artists George Miller and Janet Cardiff's 2008 piece, Murder of the Crows, as their work blasts out of around 50 speakers propped upright and spread throughout the dark, windowless gallery. Visitors can listen to the two artists that are at the forefront of their generation using advanced technology in contemporary art. Brazilian contemporary artist Tunga introduced Bernardo Paes, the mining millionaire who owns the property, to modern art, with his installation True Rouge being the first gallery to be installed on the property. Tunga has been honored even more here at Inorchim, with a gallery named after him. Symbolically, it's the only gallery to be completely encased in glass walls, as if Tunga's work is being projected throughout the windows out to the rest of the grounds. Rodrigo Mora explains Tunga's influence on Inorchim.
Since the beginning, the artists Tunga and Cildo Meirelles, amongst others, they were really influential in seeing the potential of this place as a platform to show this kind of production of installation art, of environmental scale, in its full potential. So this is the role of these artists since day one or day zero in your team. It's been really to think with us, with the curators, with the patron, how to bring an art experience to our public that is really guided to show the artist in its entirety.
Então, as orientações já conhecem, vou pedir que permaneça. Aqui eu só acrescento o silêncio por ser uma obra sonora.
One of the large-scale installations is a sonic pavilion by Doug Atkin. Located at the top perimeter of Inorchim, the high-up, large, round structure looks down on the park with its glass walls. A sound piece, the Sonic Pavilion places microphones down a 202-meter shaft to capture the sounds of the earth, which then rise up and resonate throughout the pavilion as if visitors were hearing the earth's heartbeat. Rodrigo Mora explains how this piece came to be.
The Sonic Pavilion is a piece that existed in Doug Aitken's mind before he came to Inorchim, but was really activated or took the form it has now when he came, because this is a region with such a history of mining and such a history of a relationship with the underground and the soil. So Doug first came in 2005, I believe, and the project took 4 years to finally happen. So it was extremely complex to get this drilling happening and to create this a cavity of 202 meters deep where we have the microphones that capture the sound that the viewer listens to in the pavilion.
Over at the Mata Gallery, I find my favorite piece, the 2008 Sixão Diagonal by American artist Marcus Gallen.
Well, this really tricked me. I thought that this was glass here, but really, it's a room that's cut diagonally through the middle, and it's half white, half lime green, and you think that there's a pane of glass stopping you from going in, but then you put your arm through and you realize that actually it's a wide open space and that your mind is just playing tricks on you.
Inochim is truly an experience and one that's difficult to define. And curators and directors want to keep things that way. The last thing they want here at Inochim is for the Institute to be put into a box or to be ticked off in some category. Rodrigo Mora, again.
The truth is that we resist simple categorization of our definition. We like to believe we are more a destination and a place. And in this place, of course, there are different elements that are articulated in this place, and some of them are a contemporary art center, a botanical garden, a place for social development of the region, and also the result of the combination of this different elements.
After 22 galleries, exploring botanical gardens throughout, and seeing countless art installations, my weekend at Inochim ends with a live show from Brazilian percussionist Nana Vasconcelos. It's easy to see why it's recommended that visitors spend between 2 to 3 days to actually be able to see and experience the park as a whole. But after a weekend, they might never want to leave this place, which can be seen as nothing short of magical to all lovers of art, design, and culture. For Monocle, in Inochim, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena. After the break, keep an eye on your king, because we're visiting the nation who are the best at chess.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging, and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features, and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
This is Culture. With me, Robert Bound. The tiny, impoverished Caucasian state of Armenia has never been a superpower except in one respect: chess. With a population of around 3 million people, it's one of the highest numbers of grandmasters per capita in the world. The former Soviet Republic has won 3 chess Olympics over the past decade, and in 2011 it became the first ever country to put chess on the school curriculum. Our correspondent Alexei Korolev recently travelled to Armenia to find out just what makes the Armenians so chess crazy.
I'm inside something called the Chess Academy of Armenia, a state-run institution providing top-notch chess training for pupils of all ages and abilities. Located in a rather drab suburb of the capital Yerevan, this is a gleaming modern building, complete with a sports ground and private parking lot outside there, a sign that in a country where over 30% of the population live below the poverty line, chess is something that continues to draw investment and government support. 2 flights of stairs, and I'm in a huge classroom crowded with desks with chess boards on them. Along the walls, portraits of former Armenian champions. Now, unfortunately, there are no pupils in attendance at this time, but I'm told that during classes, it's a full house here.
Grandmaster Sambat Lputan is the founding president of the academy. It was his idea to make chess compulsory in Armenian schools. He tells me why.
The effect of teaching chess is that it's an honest game. It helps children make individual decisions. It's a game of creative thinking, and that's why it helps people to both have fun and play chess.
Armenians have been playing chess for centuries, but the defining episode came in May of 1963, when Armenian Tigran Petrosyan beat Mikhail Botvinnik, a Russian, to take the world chess title. Their nearly 2 months long match was followed by millions of radio listeners and TV viewers across the Soviet Union. And while Petrosyan's victory helped to popularize chess in Armenia, the game didn't become widely played here until well into the 1980s, Batlapoutian says.
Vladimir Akopian, international grandmaster.
And it was in the 80s that grandmaster Vladimir Akopian first hit the international headlines as he clinched three junior world championships in a row. And in recent years, he helped Armenia win the International Chess Olympiad three times as a member of his country's national team. In his office at the iconic House of Chess in downtown Yerevan, I asked him what it feels like to be world champion.
This is what I tell you. I mean, this three time I was champion when junior. At that time, of course, it was something special. But I have to say that, of course, my main achievements, of course, connected with our team, because to be three-time Olympic champion, this is indeed the most important that I have done in chess.
Why is Armenia so strong in chess?
For me, it's very difficult to say that it has something to do with chess school or something. I don't think. I just believe that there were born, say, four very strong players, just with inborn very strong talent. Somehow it was probably the strong generation that was born in the 80s. And all of them, of this our new generation, they are over 30.
And has chess helped you in real life? Because it's said that chess develops problem-solving skills, develops the intellect and so on.
Okay, I always say that I don't have any proof that this is the way. I mean, the life is totally different, the chess is different. And the people say that you can calculate your moves and chessboard, the same like in your life. I would not say that this is the way.
Looking around me in the streets of Yerevan, I can't help feeling, though, that the resourcefulness and skill that Armenians display on the chessboard could and should be put to use in real life. A one-time mighty empire, a rival to Rome, no less. Armenia today is marooned in economic isolation, brought about by long-standing disputes with neighboring Turk and Azerbaijan, and most of its economy is controlled by former ruler Russia. But educationalists here argue that chess can actually help pupils get on in life.
Can someone be introduced to such an amazing game as chess and stay indifferent?
I'm with Marina Kamalan, a chess instructor here at the Patriarch Vazgan Elementary School in northern Yerevan.
In the last 3 years, chess is implemented in Armenian schools as a mandatory subject. I'm confident it benefits kids in many ways. Chess is teaching independence and responsibility. Recently, my student participated in international tournament in Jermuk, small and cozy town in Armenia. All play chess with passion. Kids come with their families. After games, I witness how all members of families discuss and analyze the game. Different generation, yes, grandfather and father, then son, all have the same interest.
But are all of your students aspiring world
it's
champions?
Not about, we are teaching here, not about making them grossmasters or, sure, some will become, but chess is helping them to feel in this life better, to
because whatever Kamalan says, there is a competitive element to learning chess. Listen to primary school student Alex Manukyan, who took first prize at last year's tournament in Jermuk, speaking in an interview with Armenian television.
I played 9 games, and even though the atmosphere was intense, I won them all easily, he says. I plan to continue playing and become a grandmaster.
For Grandmaster Vladimir Akopian, children like Alex are a promise of a brighter and better future for his country.
Very many. I mean, everywhere you can now see in chess academy, here in chess house, everywhere they are having these tournaments for children. This is good. I believe that this is good. This can bring in the future some new chess talents. But I mean, this is like hope, yeah?
For Monocle in Yerevan, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thanks, Alexei. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, we'll find out the documentaries that need to be on your radar at CPH Docs in Denmark. And there's live music from How to Dress Well. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, who's away this week, but managed to do things from afar. I'd also like to thank Alex Funnell for stepping into the breach and enjoying reading my biscuity script. Time for one final song this week from Asaf Avidan. This is My Latest Sin. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Just like distant thunder, my conscience is rolling in the back of my head. But your lips, they keep riding on in the darkness. Our guns on the floor, near the makeup and clothes that we shed. Honey, we both tread our own paths, but the grass is run out of parting ways. See, I used to think I rode with the devil, but I'm left on my own. Even he hasn't shown up these days. Don't cry, my latest sin. I don't buy that righteous mean. Demons and angels left us here all alone. Oh, much like crickets in a sunrise, my guilt is fading in the depth of my chest. Yeah, empire is crumbling all around us, but we're pressed on the wall. We don't care about the fall of the rest. Honey, I pray. Honey, I pray you find your old path, 'cause mine was lost so long ago. They say old roads were built on old rivers. Well, maybe that's why I'm lost, 'cause I just can't carry on with the flow. Don't cry, my latest sin. Just me on a call. All the demons and angels left us here all alone. All the demons and angels left us here all alone. All the demons and angels left us here.